Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Escape to Exile by B.N. Rundell, narrated by Scott Miller. Chapter 1. Duel. The tall hemlocks and white pines in the park-like setting on the south bank of the Delaware River move but little in the cool morning breeze. The twittering song of the bobolink was cut short by the call of a goshawk with its continual caw that sounded the alarm of danger. A brief moment of stillness was shattered by the barking of two Wogden and Barton dueling pistols that sounded like angry cur-dogs and spat fire and smoke. The two men stood 20 paces apart, clouds of gray-white smoke briefly obscuring each. They had turned to face one another, pistols cocked and triggers set, their fingers lightly touching the hair triggers. At the shouted command, they turned to face one another, with the older man taking a quick but careless aim and touching off his shot first, which was quickly answered by the tall, younger man. Gabriel Stonecroft slapped at his left upper arm as blood blossomed through the silken shirt sleeve. The ruffles at the wrist of the hand that held the pistol caught some of the crimson that flowed from the wound. He looked across the clearing, seeing the result of his shot, and shook his head as he dropped his gaze to the pistol still gripped in his right hand. The other man, Jason Wilson, an experienced duelist, grabbed at his neck where red stained the torn cravat that now appeared tangled at his throat. His knees buckled as he fell forward, unable to catch himself before his face hit the grass and dirt. He lost his grip on his pistol. Two men rushed to his side, both kneeling beside him, one frantically trying to stay the flow of blood as the other shook his head, mumbling to himself. He lifted his eyes to the opponent and watched as two men hustled him away, shielding his back with their own. "I believe you killed him," declared Ezra Blackwell, the lifetime friend of the combatant Gabriel Stonecroft.
"I didn't want to," answered the sandy-haired man. Only 19, he was just over 6 feet tall, pushed the scale at 190 pounds, with broad shoulders and tapered hips. He showed the stature and masculinity most admired by women and envied by men. With a square jaw, high cheekbones, hazel-green eyes, and dark eyebrows that accented his piercing gaze and his chiseled features, he would be considered handsome by any standard. For 2 years he had been an honor student at the College of Philadelphia, but he was most at home in the woods, where he and his lifetime friend, now his second, Ezra Blackwell, spent most of their time. "We had an agreement that we wouldn't draw blood, but when his shot took me in the arm, I had to answer in kind," explained Gabriel.
"You had no choice," added the man on his left. Dr. Crittenden had accompanied many to their duels, and as a longtime friend of the Stonecroft family, he had not hesitated to join Gabriel and Ezra for their bout of honor. Gabriel had acted in defense of his sister's honor when Jason Wilson had made some lewd suggestions to her at a party that was considered a prominent social event in Philadelphia, in the presence of her friends and her brother. When Gabriel stepped forward to demand an apology, Jason Wilson laughed, both at Gabriel and his sister Gwyneth.
"Ha! Neither of you is worth an apology, even if one was called for," shouted the impudent man, slurring his words as he tried to steady himself on a nearby handrail. Wilson was from a prominent and wealthy family, his father serving on the Second Continental Congress, and his mother's brother, John Rutledge, one of the first justices of the Supreme Court. Jason Wilson was a ne'er-do-well who had the reputation of a drunkard, but his family had always tolerated his behavior, and their influence had kept him out of jail. Gabriel stepped forward, but was stopped by his sister's hand on his arm. His nostrils flared as he turned to Jason Wilson. "My second will call on you to set the time and place for our meeting," he snarled, breathing deep as he fought his own restraint. So be it,
Wilson laughed, then stumbled from the room. Those nearby were silent and turned away to leave, knowing nothing could be said to avert what each one knew was coming. The three men stepped into the waiting rowboat, manned by two hired sailors, to return to the north shore of the river, and the carriage that would return them to the family estate. Gabriel stared at the back of his friend Ezra. Although a little shorter than Gabriel, Ezra was a powerfully built man, broad-shouldered and deep-chested. In Gabriel's mind, he was as strong as an ox. Ezra was the oldest son of one of the first pastors of the Mother Bethel African Methodist Episcopal Church, and the two had been inseparable friends from childhood. It was, at the least, unusual for a Negro to act as second to a gentleman in a duel, but Gabriel would consider no other. The role of the second was to supervise the loading of the pistols, and the second of the offended party would have the choice of positions, pistols, and would also call the cadence, or count the steps as the duelists stepped off to their places before turning to fire. It was also their duty, if anyone did not abide by the rules, to enforce them, even to shooting the offender. But this duel had gone strictly by the rules of the Code Duello, and the only offense had been the broken word of Wilson after the two had agreed to shed no blood. Ezra breathed deep and turned on the seat to look at his friend. You know this won't be the end of it.
I'm afraid you're right. As cantankerous as Jason was, his father is worse, answered Gabriel.
He was their only son, explained the doctor, and his father always bailed that boy out of trouble and never made him take any of the consequences. You know, of course, that he's been in three duels before this and killed them all.
Yes, sir, I knew that, but after what he said and did with Gwyneth, I couldn't let it slide. My father taught me to stand up for myself and my family. I can't count the times he said, Son, our family name is the most precious commodity we have. Never, never, never do anything that would bring shame on it, nor allow anyone else to do so.
Did he know about this? Asked Joshua Crittenden.
No, sir. I wanted to settle things first. I know he wouldn't want me to do it, but neither would he try to talk me out of it. He places a high value on a man's character, as well he should, and as he always taught me to do. But he might have wanted to take my place, and I couldn't have that.
Unless I miss my guess, old man Wilson will either come after you himself, or he'll hire some thugs to do the deed for him. I would think you should disappear, at least for a while, and maybe this will blow over.
Doc, you know it won't blow over. Even if the old man were to hunt me down and kill me, he wouldn't be satisfied. I think he'll try to destroy everything and everyone, suggested Gabriel.
You might be right, replied the doctor as he lifted his eyes to the nearing shore. Do you want me to accompany you home?
Gabriel looked down at his bandaged arm. I think this'll be all right. Anything special I need to do?
Just change the bandage. Keep the wound clean. Maybe put a little alcohol on the wound. And that's about it.
Thanks, doctor, answered Gabriel. Then, looking to Ezra, I'll just have Ezra here tend to it. He's pretty good with that kind of stuff.
Ezra grinned. I'm going to take great pleasure pouring alcohol on that wound.
I bet you will, chuckled Gabriel, standing to leave the boat.
They took the doctor to his office, then started to the family estate. Gabriel turned to Ezra.
So what do you think? Will I need to leave the country?
A slight grin tugged at the corners of his friend's mouth, and Ezra chuckled as he answered.
If I didn't know better, I'd think you'd planned it this way. You've always wanted to strike out for the wilderness and leave all this civilization behind.
Want to come with me? Asked the grinning Gabriel, watching his friend try to keep from smiling. It was an impressive, historic two-story brick home, built by the secretary to William Penn, James Logan, and had six curtained windows that stared down from the second floor,
as if showing their displeasure with the young man of the house. Three gables framed by two towering chimneys overlooked the estate, and a circular roadway that enabled visitors to step from their carriages within mere steps of the front door. When Gabriel and Ezra stepped down, Gabriel lifted his hand toward the driver. "Thanks, Thomas," and dismissed the coach. The two friends walked into the home and were greeted by the Stonecroft patriarch, Betcher Hamilton Stonecroft, who was standing at the foot of the stairs, elbow on the newel post at the end of the banister. The man had built his sizable inheritance into a massive fortune, with wise investments in shipping and manufacturing, reaping considerable profits by supplying the Continental Army with weapons and cannon. He now looked at his only heir with skepticism, relief, and consternation. His furrowed brow showed his concern as he waved the two into the study. "Well, I am relieved to see you walking, and apparently not too badly injured. After what your sister told me, I can't say as I blame you. But what about Wilson?" asked the elder statesman.
"I believe him to be dead," explained Gabriel, somber-faced but looking directly at his father. The older man sighed heavily.
"I was afraid of that. I believe you have no other recourse than to leave immediately."
Gabriel had not expected his father to be so adamant, and had hoped he might have some alternative. He leaned forward. "What do you suggest?"
"Get as far away as you can, as quick as you can."
"But what about you and Gwyneth?"
"Don't concern yourself with us. I believe your sister will soon wed Hamilton Claiborne, and he is bound to take her to Washington."
"Washington? Why there?"
"They're already talking about moving the capital to Washington, and he is soon to have his law license, and I believe they are a good match."
"But won't the senior Wilson come after you if I'm not here?" asked Gabriel, scowling as he scooted to the edge of his chair.
"Ha! That popinjay doesn't have near the influence and money he pretends to have. Oh, don't get me wrong, he'll try to exact some kind of revenge. But he'll send some thugs, and when they find out you've gone, he won't dare lift a hand against me. I'll have his head in a handbasket. Ha!"
he pronounced with a smack of his fist on the desktop. He stood up behind the desk, leaned forward.
"Besides, haven't you always wanted to try your hand at exploring the wilderness?"
Gabriel was surprised by his father's suggestion. This man had always emphasized education and position, but he now stood to his feet to turn aside.
"Of course I have. Every time I walked into this room..."
He waved his arm toward the walls, which were mounted with maps, elk antlers, gun racks, and other weaponry that told of his father's many exploits and adventures, both here and abroad. "From the first time you told me of your hunts with Grandfather and your fighting with Morgan's sharpshooters, I wanted to have my own adventures, not for trophies or battles, but to explore and see more of this great land."
Mr. Stonecroft glanced at Ezra. "What about you? It seems to me every time he," motioning to his son, "went into the woods, you were with him."
"I'd sure like to, but I don't know what my father would say," answered Ezra.
"Suppose you go find out and get back if you can."
Ezra jumped to his feet, waved to his friend, and ran to the door. Betcher Stonecroft turned to his son.
"So, what say we start getting you packed?"
suggested his smiling father.
Chapter 2. Departure. He doffed his silk blouse for a coarse linen hunting shirt, his breeches and spatterdashes for durable linen trousers, and his cravat gave way to a neckerchief. Buckled shoes were surrendered in favor of boots, and his waistcoat and coat were replaced by a woolen greatcoat. Even the tricorn was replaced by a broad-brimmed felt hat. Gabriel stood before his father, hands held out to his sides to model his new attire, and his father grinned.
"If I didn't know it was you, I would find it quite difficult to recognize you."
"As you said, the wardrobe of a gentleman is not suitable for the wilderness. I hope to find an Indian village,
perhaps Potawatomi, and trade for some buckskins.
That would be wise. When I went with your grandfather, we both wore buckskins, but of course that was many years ago, mused Betcher. Come, join me in the study.
As they stepped into the man's lair, Gabriel noticed several items arrayed on the old man's desk. He watched his father pick up the smaller item, a finely crafted Flemish knife.
This is the type of knife used by the courier des bois, and both fit this sheath.
He pointed to the leather sheath that held the drop-point knives, one about 13 inches and the second about 8.
You can carry it at your belt, in your boot, or between your shoulders at your back, or you can add a neck thong.
Handing the knives and sheath to his son, he turned back to the desk and picked up a rifle. He grinned as he handed it to Gabriel. But father, that's your Ferguson.
That's right. And if you remember, there were only 5 of us in the sharpshooters during the War of Independence who were equipped with them. But you know all that, and you've proven you know how to use this. Don't forget, use beeswax on the breech screw every, 50 rounds or so.
I am honored that you would allow me to take it, father. The gray-haired man dropped his eyes, cleared his throat as he turned.
And this, you've wanted it since you first used it.
When he turned back to face his son, he held a Mongol recurve composite bow in his hands. Although unstrung, Gabriel recognized it as his weapon of choice. He had become expert with the powerful weapon, using it many times during his forays into the woods. With a core of bamboo, horn on the belly, and sinew on the back, it was all bound together with animal glue and covered with a thin layer of birch bark. With an effective range of 500 yards in the hand of a master, it had often proved more lethal than a common rifle or musket. Betcher held it and the hard leather quiver full of arrows that measured over a yard long, with the tail feathers of an eagle for fletching.
Now there are 3 whistling arrows in there, but the others have metal blades for points.
Father, this is the pride of your collection, declared an astounded Gabriel.
Yes, but that didn't stop you from sneaking it out every chance you got, answered the elder, chuckling. Now, I suggest you take your pick of the other rifles to have as a backup, and probably one for Ezra if he's coming. Now, here,
he picked up an obviously heavy drawstring pouch,
is enough gold to keep you well supplied for some time. You should also purchase some trade goods to be used as you travel. However, I will make arrangements with my lawyer, Sutterfield, to set up an account at the bank for you to draw on as needed. The details are written out and in the pouch.
He paused and leaned back to sit on the edge of the desk, then lifted his eyes to his son.
I'm getting old, and I don't know how much time I have left.
He held up his hand to stay the objections of his son.
I have made out my will, and except for a pittance of an allowance for Gwyneth, my estate will be liquidated and deposited in the account that will be set up by Sutterfield. It will be at your disposal, and probably your heirs as well.
Gabriel took the Ferguson, the Mongol bow and its sheath, the quiver, and the pouch of gold, while Betcher carried the knives, spare rifle, and the possible's pouch and powder horn. They had just stepped out the back door and started toward the livery when they were hailed by Ezra, riding his cross-bred, long-legged bay horse.
Hey, looks like I'll be tagging along. That is, if the invitation is still open.
Gabriel chuckled. Of course it is. And honestly, I don't think I'd know what to do in the woods if you weren't by my side.
Well, somebody's got to protect you since you're so prone to getting into trouble at every turn, he announced as he stepped down.
As they walked into the livery, the cook and house manager, Daniel, was bent over 2 large leather panniers, stuffing them full of supplies for the journey. Betcher turned to his son.
I asked Daniel to load up the packs with ample goods and hardware, and the sorrel will do for your pack horse. She's nice and steady, and won't spook at much of anything, so you won't need to concern yourself about your pack horse running off with all your equipment.
He walked to the first stall and stopped, then put his armload down beside the stall door and turned to smile at his son.
"You don't mean," started Gabriel, but was stopped by his father's upheld hand.
"Yes, I do. Ebony here is the best traveling horse I have, and you will definitely need him. Besides, ever since I bought him from that gypsy," nodding at the stall, "he's been chomping at the bit to get out where he can stretch his legs."
Gabriel stepped to the half door and reached up to stroke the head and cheeks of the black horse, who answered with a low rumble and using his lips to nibble at Gabriel's arm. The two had been friends and companions for over a year since he first came to the family, and had been together on all the recent journeys into the woods. Standing just shy of 16 hands, long-backed with a big rump and well-muscled forequarters, the stallion lacked a touch of color anywhere, so the name Ebony suited him well.
"According to that gypsy, this horse is of the Andalusian breed, and that long mane and tail are typical of show horses. But where you're going, you might want to trim him up a mite," suggested Betcher. "Also, since you'll be traveling incognito, I suggest you take my saddle instead of that fancy one of yours. With a fancy horse and saddle under you, you won't pass for a typical farmer or laborer, so trim him up first chance you get."
His father's saddle was similar to the dragoon saddles, with two holsters for pistols, beside the minimal pommel, metal stirrups, and thongs for a bedroll behind the cantle. As he lifted the saddle, he saw that the holsters both contained pistols, but he hastily finished saddling the horse, led him out of the stall and into the light. He was closely followed by Daniel leading the sorrel pack horse, pack and panniers aboard. Gabriel tied on his bedroll, slipped the Ferguson into the scabbard, hung the quiver of arrows beneath the end of his bedroll, and slipped the sheath bow between the stirrup leather and the fenders. As he turned, his father said,
"I've tied the spare rifles aboard the packs, and there's more powder, lead, and molds in the pannier."
He looked wistfully at his son, tears welling up, and held out his arms for an embrace. As the two men hugged one another, nothing was said, but everything was deeply felt. When they stepped back, each forcing a smile, Gabriel was the first to speak.
"I will miss you, father."
"And I you, my son. But even if the duel had not happened, this time was coming upon us anyway. All I can say is, make me proud."
"You know I'll always do my best," choked Gabriel, quickly turning to mount up.
As he swung his leg over his bedroll, he settled into the seat, then took one last look at his home and his father.
"Give Gwyneth a hug for me, and tell her I'll always be thinking of her."
"I will," answered his father simply, stepping back.
The two men rode from the estate into the dwindling light of the day, knowing darkness would soon be upon them. But they were traveling familiar roads, and wanted miles behind them. They rode silently for several miles, until Ezra asked,
"You have any idea where we're going?"
Gabriel chuckled.
"Into the sunset."
Ezra laughed.
"Can't you ever answer a question outright instead of with all that flowery, imaginative stuff?"
"How about I just say, into the darkness?"
"Won't be the first time we went somewhere we had no idea where we were or where we were going," grumbled Ezra.
"Well, Ezra, my friend, north is cold, south is hot, and west is unknown. Given the choice, I choose west. How about you?"
"Sounds reasonable. Sides, from all we've read about the French, the Spaniards, and others out there, they sound just about as ornery as everybody around here, so don't seem like we got much to lose sepping our hair to some of those unknown Indians."
"You're certainly optimistic. How about remembering all those times we used to sit in the woods sharing our dreams of being some great explorers and discovering new territories and finding treasure and all that?"
'cause we ain't kids anymore, in case you hadn't noticed.
Ah, but adventure awaits,' declared Gabriel, lifting his arms and laughing as if the entire world belonged to the two of them.
Chapter 3 Discovery. When the first light of day began to paint their backs with dimpled shadows, Gabriel and Ezra reined up on the bank of the west branch of Brandywine Creek. The thick oak and hickory woods on the west bank invited them to make camp, and they pushed across the stream as the rising sun bent its first rays into the forest. A small clearing bordered by sparse buttonbush and dogwood offered cover, and the grass invited the horses to graze. They stripped the gear from the horses, and Ezra readied the utensils and foodstuffs as Gabriel fetched some firewood and started a fire. He had become skilled with his flint and steel, and quickly had the tinder burning. Soon the fire was ready for Ezra to display his cooking skills. After putting the coffee on, Gabriel leaned back against the remaining pannier, and as he watched Ezra putzing around, he said, "We made good time last night, and I think I'd like to travel at night again, at least until we get to the Susquehanna. If we push on through the night on the Strasburg Road, shouldn't be too many travelers, and we might make it to the river, or at least close to it. There was a man in my father's church who had traveled the Susquehanna, hunting and such. He said there's a crossing at the road from Strasburg. The river's about 3, maybe 4 feet deep, and the current ain't bad. It's just upstream from a pair of islands and just off the bank. Well, depending on when we get there, and if the horses aren't too tired, should be daylight, and we can find us a place to sleep on the other side. And after that, we might think about giving the horses a rest before we take to the mountains," advised Ezra as he flipped the meat in the pan. He sat the skillet at the edge of the fire and sat back to let the meat finish cooking, picked up a cup and poured himself some coffee. He glanced across the fire at his friend. "You know, we might not ever come back this way again. Might not ever see any of our family again. You think about that?"
"Constantly. And Ezra, I want you to know a couple things. First, I'm mighty grateful you chose to join me. And second, if and when you ever get to thinking about home and you want to go back, just say the word. That's easy for you to say now, but you might not be welcome back there. No telling what old man Wilson will conspire to do. For all we know, he already has somebody on our trail," declared Ezra, sipping his coffee and looking over the brim of the cup wide-eyed.
"But what I meant was, if you get the hankering to go home, and even if I can't, don't feel obligated to hold my hand like a school kid. You just get and skedaddle. Understand?"
responded Gabriel. Ezra chuckled.
"Some folks have said you and me are like two sides of the same coin. Course, I never asked them which one was heads and which was tails, but I ain't about to let you do all the exploring and adventuring without me."
Gabriel grinned, finished his coffee.
"Ain't that meat about done?"
"Mm-hmm.
Get your plate and let's eat,"
declared Ezra, pushing himself up to reach for the pan. The sun was bouncing its golden rays off the surface of the Susquehanna, casting a rippling light on the far bank and the trees and shrubs that lined the edge. A break in the brush marked a seldom-used trail originally traveled by the Lenape, Shawnee, or tribes of the Iroquois Confederacy. Gabriel reached down to stroke the neck of his horse.
"What do you think, Ebony? Want to give it a try?"
Ezra said,
"Well, I ain't Ebony, but I think they'll do all right. We kind of took it easy on them, and the road's been all right, so I say we cross over and fix us something to eat."
Gabriel put his heels to Ebony's sides and started into the water. The big black willingly stepped off the slippery bank and walked into the ripples. The gravelly bottom showed shallow, and the two small tree-covered islands were no more than 30 yards to their right. But once past the gravel shore, the water deepened, and the leather tapaderos barely touched water. The current was slow and the crossing easy, and within moments all three horses were starting to shake as both Gabriel and Ezra stepped down.
The rattle of gear and slap of leather made both men step back until the horses finished their shaking. Then they led the
sample complete. Ready to continue?